You're listening to By the Well, a lectionary-based podcast for preachers with Fran Barber and Robin Whittaker.
Hi everyone, Robin here. We're in the seventh Sunday after Pentecost, or proper 10, and today Fran and I are going to discuss 2 Samuel 6, 1-19, Ephesians 1, 3-14, and Mark 6, 14-29. Let's start with the Samuel text, Fran.
Yeah, and we probably need to say a couple of comments just around its context. So the struggle for power between David and Saul has come to an end. And David's been recognised by all the tribes of Israel, having only been recognised by a couple in the first instance. Fighting between with Israel and the Philistines has continued. And the central symbol of Israel, the Ark of the Covenant, hasn't been seen in Jerusalem just yet.
Yeah, and this story narrates its entry with dancing. Those of you who you know, once watched, and I haven't done this for many years, the big sort of Bible mega films like the Charlton Heston one might remember the scene of David dancing in a slightly whirlish and over-the-top manner as the Ark enters Jerusalem. And I think that does actually capture some of the strangeness of this scene.
So the lectionary text leaves out a portion, which in usual style I'm going to suggest be worth reading through before you consider whether you'll preach on this or not. So it's this funny section where a guy called Uzzah sticks his hand out to steady the ark, which is rocking back and forth on
the cart.
Cart as it's being carried. And the Lord strikes him down, perhaps is interpreting this as overly familiar.
Yes.
Gesture. It's a strange little passage, and then David gets really angry with the Lord, which I think is interesting alongside his abundant joy. There's something in this passage about David we've mentioned before, that his complete presence emotionally to God in whatever frame of mind he finds himself in.
Emotions.
Yeah. So he's really pretty peeved that this has happened, and so peeved that actually the ark doesn't arrive in Jerusalem for another 3 months.
Yep.
So it's a funny little passage because I think it's worth reading for those reasons around the emotional responses in there, but also it does add a level of ambiguity or ambivalence around what the presence of God might mean. Because without that little portion of the lectionary passage, it looks unalloyed joy that the presence of God brings.
And in fact, it's in there precisely because the ark has a complex history. It's described in different ways in the Old Testament. So in both Deuteronomy and I think it's Exodus, it's described in one text, it's a kind of a wooden box. It's very simple. In another, it's ornate and golden and carved. But either way, it represents the presence of God. And we'll link in the show notes, there's a great short article on Bible Odyssey by a female scholar called Maria Metzler that just points you to those texts if you want to explore that more. But in 1 and 2 Samuel, it is this destructive force. It's been used. It was carried off by the Philistines and destroys them and their God to the point that they return it.
Yeah.
And go, we don't want this.
It's jinxed us.
Yes. It's kind of almost. So the militaristic and the cultic are completely intertwined in these ancient texts, reflecting the realities of the way nations thought about their deities going into war with and for them. But that's problematic to us. But
yes.
It's just a historical
It is problematic to our ears because we've got modern ears and it sounds strange, but it's also naming something that we modern humans have done very much in living memory and still do, which is to associate our own winning, whatever that means, metaphorically or actually, as being where the presence of God is, or God being with us because we've won.
Yes.
So there is some material here to touch on in preaching or a theme around what it is to co-opt the presence of God, or to, with enormous unconscious self-interest, assume the presence of God. This passage could help unpack the problems with that.
Definitely. And if you really wanted to unpack some of the ways we keep doing that, you don't have to go back very far, and there are probably more contemporary examples, but the obvious one that came to mind for me was, you know, after September 11, in declaring war, George Bush evoked language of crusades explicitly and talked about, you know, going out to get rid of evildoers in the world, all under the guise of God bless America. Mm. So, I mean, the religious language and the evoking of God in warfare continues in slightly more subtle but still very
well, and
real.
Therefore if it's subtle, it's often more damaging. Yeah. Or
Trump holding up that Bible in front of the church. And I mean, there are ways that, you know. On a more positive note, I think if I was going to preach this, I might use the text as a bit of a jumping off point. And I don't do this often because I am about wanting to kind of not skip over the complexities of the text, and I think they do need to be named. But there's something here, some of the questions this raises for me are, how do we in our communities embody the kind of joy and excitement that David embodies in his whirlish dancing, and dancing that he gets critiqued for by Michal, one of his wives, who's watching in verse 16, and criticizes him for exposing himself. It's not manly, kingly behavior to carry on like this. So there's some questions there around how might this challenge our own
inhibitions.
In our white Protestant churches, we can be very,
reserved
in our worship of the Lord. And the other theme that struck me, on a positive note, David wants to bring God into the very heart of Jerusalem.
Mm.
Now, he might be wanting to do that for all sorts of complex and problematic reasons, including this is the power of God that helps him win wars. But, you know, again, if we take it as a bit of a hint of where we could go, there's reflection there about how we do and can bring God into the heart of our lives as communities, into the heart of our lives as families, as individuals, and what that might look like. Maybe with the caveat you named before of without self-interest.
And one final point I'd make, because we were going to look at three today, so we won't spend as long, but that Christologically or for Christians, the presence of God is enfleshed in the incarnation primarily, and that presence is also, at one level, quite ambivalent or ambiguous. That is, that Christ went to the cross, and so that the presence of God is about suffering and God-forsakenness.
Mm.
And so that's kind of a message for every sermon, isn't it? But I think that this passage could lead on to some remarks and some good news about what the presence of God looks like in Christ.
Yeah, and in that sense pair quite nicely with where we're going to go in both Ephesians and actually the Mark reading today. Yeah. So let's go to Ephesians next.
Yep.
So this is – and we should say for those of you who preach regularly, this is the first week of several weeks now that we're going to have a string of Ephesians readings. Mm. This is a letter that in the tradition is considered as one of four that Paul wrote from prison, along with Colossians, which has a lot in common with Philemon and Philippians. Now, the scholarly view is this is most likely later, written by Pauline followers, so picking up the tradition of Paul, but some years, decades after Paul died. For the purposes of preaching, it actually doesn't make a huge difference, I don't think.
No.
But one of the dominant themes in this letter is unity. So if unity is a challenge for your community, this is your text, because it's going to track out unity in various ways. And we see that in a particular way in the passage we've got today.
Yeah.
The other thing I'll say by way of introduction is verse 3 to 14, which is our entire text, which is many, many sentences in English.
Yes, one.
Is one Greek sentence.
Yeah.
So we can't. While in preaching we might want to pick up or emphasize a theme or two, it's one thought under this heading of blessed is God who behaves like this.
And that grammatical fun fact, actually, I find really helpful, because I would describe this as abundant across time language that Paul, or the author, Paul's friend, is using here. It's adoption, inheritance, destiny, blessing. Like, there's no aspect of reality or existence that isn't covered by this. And there's the abundance and the excess is almost displayed in a sentence that goes on for 200 words.
Yes.
You know, or the joy of it.
Yep.
Um,
it is. And I mean, so in a normal epistolary form, this is part of the thanksgiving, but it's not I give thanks, which we get in so many Pauline type letters. It's blessed. It's this very Jewish declaring the blessedness of God. And for me, had resonances of, you know, the very first covenant, or one of the Abrahamic covenant, I should say, which is blessed to be a blessing, because it summarizes what God has done for the hearer, but also says, therefore, you go do these things.
It's very descriptive and indicative. I think that's the word, isn't it? I think it's also a passage. It's about election. So in the language of the tradition of the church, this is a passage that was picked up by theologians like Calvin and later, and tussled around. What I suppose the important thing, and this would, I'm not a Calvinist, so for us not to read this passage as about us. This is about God, not about whether we're measuring up to what's being said here, but that is very secondary. What's being declared is the abundant grace of God. This is the case. You are adopted. Mm. This is happening. This is the focus is on this is what it is to be in Christ, whether you like it or not, almost. Not an emphasis on whether you've done enough to be there.
Whether you're worthy of it.
This is actually the truth, folks. This is where this is countercultural, because this is a meta narrative of the most meta kind. And when we're speaking to our people, we're all in a culture where meta narratives are very not in vogue.
Yes.
You know, everyone's story is of equal value and every story's true.
And highly individualized.
This is the story, folks. You won't find a better one. A more abundant one, a more grace-filled one, and it's yours.
Yes.
Preach it.
Preach it. And, I mean, I think for churches, I say this as much as a challenge for myself, because I normally, if I'm honest, run screaming from Ephesians and similar.
I would go towards it.
But I would say, particularly in establishment churches where we're not used to preaching the kind of, you know, summing up the gospel type sermons that sort of seeker churches do, it never hurts to revisit. And this is almost the perfect passage for, I mean, it takes us back to the time pre-creation of, so this language of, I think in the NRSV is predestined, which immediately evokes Calvin in a problematic way. The NT Wright version has he foreordained, or it's like he foredecided that we would be adopted as sons and daughters. It's not about exclusivity. It's about God pre-deciding before any of us came into being that this would be the nature of the way God would bring us into God's family.
Which is incredibly generous, because otherwise it could say, well, I waited till some of you came along and then went, oh.
Are you good enough?
No.
I like you.
No, but grace is the first thing. I totally agree. I think I would grab this. This is an opportunity to reaffirm baptism. I think probably with fewer people baptised in mainline churches now than has been so in the past, that sermons on baptism are not occurring as often. This is a chance to preach on your baptism and renew those vows with the community.
Yes.
And emphasise the non-individualistic, utterly communal sort of world and story we're called into.
And the abundance you pointed out in verse 8, this idea of the riches of his grace which he lavished on us. I mean, the language here is rich and it does need to be well read. I want to point people to the unity. So the purpose, I mean, towards the end of the passage, verse 11 onwards, talks about this inheritance we've received that was pre-decided by God that we would receive, you know. And it talks about language of purpose. What's the point of all of this? And it is so that all people will sort of come together, if you like, and in both heaven and on earth. So it's cosmic. And for those who are into sort of more an eco-theology, moving beyond, again, the human even, this reminds me of, you know, Romans 8 and the all creation groaned. Mm. This is a cosmic vision of God bringing everything together in Christ.
And for the sole purpose of praising this giver.
Yes.
So our purpose is not to live up to this thing. This thing is true.
Yeah.
The purpose of our existence is to praise the glory of the God, the giver.
Because God behaves like this.
Because God is like that. And we are, is to bless God who blesses.
That's beautiful.
Did you know we have a Facebook group? You can find a link at our website, fatherwell.com.au.
So we're changing direction somewhat with the Mark passage, the story of the beheading of John the Baptist, although it isn't actually – this passage isn't about John the Baptist really. Like this is a story that's told by, you know, it's a passage about who Jesus is.
Even though Jesus isn't really in it, but yes.
Yes, that's what I mean, you know, like it's –
By point of contrast, it's about John, but we're actually supposed to see all the mirroring of Jesus. It's a foreshadowing of Jesus' own death, which we've already noted in previous episodes. Mark does all over the place. So we should, you know.
Some textual points first, maybe? Or?
Yeah. So, I mean, the language, again, it's all through the, scattered through the passage. I haven't noted every verse, but, you know, this language of John being arrested in prison, bound, ultimately his body placed in a tomb. All of those, we're going to see a number of those key verbs get repeated in chapter 14 and 15 in the Passion.
Okay, I hadn't noted that there. That's helpful.
But maybe some context. We're here in chapter 6, just after Jesus has sent out the 12 on mission. And so this is almost a little aside and then a flashback that happens while they're away on mission, and then they come back to Jesus and report. But that setting is important because I think we're supposed to see that mission and ministry, in other words, apostleship, he sends them with this apostello word, is framing this story. And I would say it's ultimately a story of costly discipleship, which almost any week of Mark you could say it's a story.
But it comes just before the feeding of the 5,000.
It does. So. And if we're pointing forward in the lectionary again, you could do this looking back next time or this week. This is a particular kind of feast, and then we're going to get a different kind of feast. Yeah. So there's other comparisons to be made. Historically, too, we should say the Herod family nonsense is highly complex because Herod the Great had 10 wives. So who's related to, and they tended to intermarry. So I'll try and keep this short, the short version. Herodias in this story, who Mark, amongst all the synoptics, very much blames. The others will lessen who's at fault here. Some will place the emphasis more on Herod's action. But Herodias is blamed here. Herod Antipas in this text's wife, who was previously married to another of her uncles who she's divorced.
It sounds like Days of Our Lives. Not that I've ever watched it, but from what people have said, that sounds... Anyway, press on.
And this man she's married to in this our story is also another one of her uncles. So we do have an older male, which is typical in the ancient world, and a niece. So her daughter from the previous marriage is both Herod's niece and his stepdaughter. It's all
okay.
All that is to say, it's highly enmeshed, complex, and John the Baptist has criticized this in a kind of prophetic speaking against power, drawing on both Deuteronomy and Levitical readings that talk about not marrying your niece or not, and Qumran readings and not sleeping with your in-laws and that kind of stuff.
Okay.
All that's in the background. Sorry, that was long.
No, that is actually helpful. Even though I probably wouldn't bother keeping track of the particular detail.
No, and don't need to do a family lineage in a sermon, but, you know.
Yeah.
What did you notice, Fran?
Well, I noticed some contrasts or some similarities with a story about Jesus and Pilate and what's going on here. So my big picture notices.
Yep.
I didn't notice anything fine here, like detailed, but more that this was another man like Pilate who's presented with the challenge by those around him to put to death someone that actually he's fairly ambivalent about. So it says, what is it? Where's the bit where Herod says what he thinks of him?
Well, in verse 20, it talks about Herod being afraid of John.
Yes. And a righteous and holy man.
Yes.
So he was greatly perplexed by John, but he liked to listen to him. I like that. I actually underlined that for the whole experience of delivering and hearing sermons, folks. Yes. The importance of having people perplexed and yet liking to listen to you. Sort of holding that tension.
Because there's both challenge but something intriguing.
There's something intriguing here. I know that, you're driving me nuts, but I can't. I don't not really listen. Like it. Yeah, but yeah. Yes, yeah. Anyway, so, but something beautiful about that, I thought. So I really do know, I did note that, so Herod's a powerful man with everything at his fingertips. He's in a web of relationships. He's trying to please everybody.
Mm-hmm. And retain his power.
And retain his power. And so he does the most low thing. This is loaded. I know that because I'm a disciple this end of the event.
Yeah.
But he kills the wrong person. Like yes. He does what is most expeditious for him.
Yes. And
Pilate does that with Jesus. Yes. And so I can see at the narrative level very clearly this is about Jesus' identity. Look, folks, this is who I said it was and who it will be.
Yeah.
And also the line at the end about the disciples heard about it, John's death, and took his body and put it in a tomb. Well, they failed to do that with Jesus, but there's also something quite beautiful and touching about that line in this passage, I think, at the human level. So
of caring for their leader, even at maybe some danger. Yeah, I mean, I think this is there's a very human, relatable element to Herod. We might not have his power, wealth, and lavish lifestyle, most of us, but anyone in leadership encounters situations where we have the opportunity, bear with me, to compromise, you know, in that we might be inclined to do what we know is actually not the right thing because it's the easy thing or it's the popular thing, it's the politically expedient thing, as opposed to, I mean, Herod knows that there's, you know, the language in the text is around him grieving. He knows as soon as this request is made that this is not a good thing, but he goes through with his oath again to save face. So all that kind of pressure of honour, shame stuff going on.
So I think there's preaching material there about resisting Herod's, the equivalent of Herod's approach in our context, individual and communal.
Yeah, and even though Mark has Herodias be the kind of foil, the obvious bad person, he still depicts Herod as deeply problematic, kind of immoral leader. Mm. And that's partly in the feasting, so celebrating birthdays. Some scholars will point to this wasn't a particularly Jewish thing to do. It was a very pagan thing to do, to have birthday feasts. So Herod is supposed to be Jewish. His family is Jewish, but he's behaving like those other people. And the lavishness of the feast, the dancing girls, the fact his daughter dances is absolutely shocking. So you might have entertainers. Ancient texts will talk about flute girls and entertainers at banquets, at lavish banquets. But they're usually taken from probably like slave classes and were often also sexually available to guests. So for his own daughter to be performing in this way.
So that's in line with all the messy relationship stuff that John's already told him off for.
Yeah. Yes, it's portraying him very much as immoral and compromised at every level of by which you might measure a man.
Yeah.
The other thing that people might miss, because this was new to me, in verse 23, this promise that Herod offers to Salome, the stepdaughter, asking, you know, what do you want? Up to half my kingdom I'll give you, it will be yours, is almost a direct parallel with Esther chapter 5, where the king there says to Esther, what do you want? Up to half my kingdom I'll give you. And Esther in that example, so you both got, you know, two older kings offering this to young Jewish girls. And the difference being Esther in that story uses that power that's suddenly afforded her to save the Jewish people.
Mm.
And Salome, through her mother, uses that opportunity given her to kill a Jewish prophet. Mm. And again, there's something there about the choices we make, I think, you could play with when given opportunity.
Mm. And I don't want to put you on the spot mid-recording, but it did occur to me, is there something to be said about Herod's prediction of John? So in verse 16, when Herod heard of it, that is the quibble about who Jesus is, John the Baptizer has been raised from the dead.
Yeah.
So he's a Hellenist, Herod, isn't he?
Well, he's a Hellenistic Jewish man. I mean, Herodian family were set up as, it's why in, you know, Matthew's gospel, Herod is called King Herod. He's supposed to be king of the Jews. So when Jesus is called king of the Jews, that's a challenge to Herod.
Yes, yes.
I would read that as reflecting perhaps the surrounding culture of apocalyptic speculation.
So Hellenist religions would also have spoken in those terms of resurrection?
No, but probably Jewish yeah. apocalyptic speculation. So Elijah is associated in Malachi with coming before the great day. And the fact he's even speculating, it is odd that he's speculating that John has been raised from the dead, suggests he thinks there's something in the water that
there is something super significant about yeah. this man, which is going back to what we said yep. at first. Yep. Yeah, that his recognition that John has something to say that needs to yep. be taken note of. Yeah.
And that even though he's not portrayed as a particularly faithful practicing Jew, whatever all those things mean, he still embodies that apocalyptic expectation, which of course Jesus reflects, and expectations around the Messiah reflect. Mm. So that's a theme we get throughout Mark as well. So it's worth noting, yeah. If you were to preach this, would you preach Mark or you'd just preach Ephesians?
I would preach Ephesians probably.
Yeah. I mean, I think yeah. there's something to be said for preaching Mark, particularly if you might preach, although you could probably pick up this story if you preach the feeding next week and the comparison of the kings. Mm. But there is something here about the cost of...
There are echoes with the Samuel one with the dancing, even in yeah. bringing in, you know...
Yeah, you can play with that.
Where is the presence of God in this story of Herod?
Yeah.
You know, where is God here? I don't know.
Yeah, that's a bleak question. I mean, it's maybe in the kindness of disciples who are faithful enough to bury a body, yeah, but any vindication will come much later.
But, you know, also the people nutting around trying to work it out and actually using the right categories of resurrection but still proceeding as if the world were as it's always been.
Yep. And ignoring the prophet in their midst.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, John was effectively a prophet speaking to power, and that's what got him killed. So there's a sobering reminder there.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening.
By the Well is brought to you by Pilgrim Theological College, the Uniting Church in Australia, and produced by Adrian Jackson.